He called his boy, at least the one that is most famous, Deo, daughters, given by God. Of course, he gave him the name after Augustine's own conversion. Later on, as Augustine was instructed in the faith and ordained in Hippo in Africa, he again formed a group, but this time directed to the formation of clerics as a seminary. Finally, as bishop, on the date is 396, he organized the whole life of his clergy. I don't know if everybody in the diocese of Hippo remained in the diocese or some begged to go elsewhere. But he told them, "Now, my dear friends," he must have called a conclave and said, "I've made a decision in the Lord. After a certain date, you will all be religious." "That's right. Do you want to stay in the diocese?" They probably said to each other, "Well, where can we go?" He organized the whole life of his clergy around him with three qualities. Common life, they were to live together. No apartment house living. Second, renunciation of property. As there are plenty of poor people in Hippo for you priests to share your possessions with. And thirdly, obedience. Needless to say, he left no doubt who was their superior. The purpose was mainly to direct the pastoral service of the priests, rather than, as before, to theological activity. Before we leave Augustine, we should note that there are two letters of St. Augustine, one of which has become the standard for women's communities that follow in the Augustinian spirit. But Augustine never thought for a moment that these women would be ordained. Augustine, therefore, really drafted two principal rules, one for men and the other for women. Side by side with this clerical monasticism, the West also had its proponents of monasticism as it was lived in the East, which is the older type, and was exemplified by the rule of life fostered by such men as St. Martin of Tours. What is St. Martin famous for? He divided his cloak. John Cassian of Marseille, also in France. St. Caesarius of Arles, also in France. Of these, John Cassian was the most important because he bequeathed in his writings his own distillation of the Eastern form of monasticism. But Caesarius, besides Cassian, is equally important because it was his rule that gave the idea of stability to monastic life. And later on, Benedict would adopt and make one of the principal features of monasticism. So much for a bit of history. Now the principal characteristics necessarily, I have touched only on the highlights of that very early structured religious life. I thought better than go into more historical detail to try to synthesize a lot of material and classified under certain main headings, all typifying religious life before Benedict. First feature, its purpose. The life of the monks and nuns was much more systematized than that of the earlier virgins and ascetics. Its immediate goal was sanctification of the villages. Contemplation through prayer and victory over the flesh through mortification were, so it was held, bound to lead to holiness. There are three P's that typify this purpose, which is also a P. Prayer and penance leads to perfection. The monks and nuns did not aspire to the priesthood. In fact, they desired not to be ordained. Even when, as under Augustine, some clerics were formed into monastic communities, it was, listen to this, priests who became religious and not religious who became priests. This, I call it dialectic, between the priesthood and the religious state, would remain throughout the centuries as a source of tension and difficulty, but also of development, even to the present day. So much for purpose. The primary purpose was perfection. The principal means were prayer and penance. Second, obedience. As good Christians, these early religious owed obedience, of course, to their bishop in religious matters, and their profession, if rightly lived, made prompt and complete submission easy. But religious obedience, as the Church conceives it, was associated only with community or celibatic life. You hear that? That is a great moment. This is now my eighth year in working, such as I'm doing, as a consultant of the Holy See. And many questions and problems that I sometimes look at and make some comments on, I keep saying to myself and, well, telling others like yourselves, you can practically forget about obedience if you don't have a strong community life. If you allow religious to do whatever, well, they individually want to do, no matter how holy or good it may be, the moment they separate themselves from the community, from living together, praying together, working together for a common end, what happens to major superiors, as I've told one mother general, who later became the head of the major superiors of women religious in America. Mother, you know what you are? What? You are the very gentle spiritual counselor of your community. You've got no authority left. She said, you're right. It's community life. It calls for religious obedience. The ramifications and interpenetrations of these two community and obedience are manifold, just to state the fact. Depending, therefore, on how communal the monastic life was, religious obedience took its form and made its demands accordingly. Third characteristic, poverty. At the time of which we are speaking, poverty consisted in the renunciation of worldly goods, and in the most sparing use of food, clothing, and all necessaries. The motto of religious life before Benedict was expressed in this phrase, no luxuries and mortification in necessities. Which, by the way, is not a bad thing to remember. Some religious actually think they're supposed to mortify themselves in their luxuries. Like another Mother General, I'm sure I must have quoted this to you on one occasion, a priest friend of mine, a canonist, heard this from the man who saw this Mother General off, whom I know well, the Mother General. She had just finished a lecture she gave in Ottawa to a Canon Law Society of Canada. And as he bade her Godspeed, he looked in the back, and there, the whole back of the car was her wardrobe. Well, so she might maybe do with one or two dresses less. That's not mortification. A religious, I'm quoting the early church, no luxuries. Mortification and necessities. My fourth year in dealing with Mother Teresa's group, all I can tell you is, those who have the vocation like it rough. And they're unhappy when they find it too easy. They say there's something wrong, and their instincts are right. You don't make religious life hard for the sake of making it hard. But why become a religious? Unless you give something up. Moreover, the Cenobites, as they were called, the monks and nuns living in communities, were forbidden to enjoy any separate property. Absolute dispossession was the common law in the church up to the Reformation. There were no simple vows of poverty. You either gave everything up or you were not a religious. They had to receive from their superior or procurator, as he was also or she was called, everything they needed for their use. Now, there were abuses, but we're talking about the religious life that survived and whose rules have endured to the modern times. Fourth characteristic, chastity. Celibacy was an assumed prerequisite for the monastic life. Yet, as in the case of Augustine, this did not mean that persons who had not lived chaste lives before could not be religious. A consoling thought. Moreover, provision was made for widows and widowers, also for married persons, who, having provided for their spouse and children, might give themselves to the religious life, living thenceforth in celibacy. Marriage for a monk or a nun, once they had left the world, was simply unthinkable. Fifth feature, vows. Having once entered the life of a virgin, or ascetic, or monk, or nun, the person felt a clear obligation to persevere. Always before them, in the earliest stages of religious life, and this passage keeps recurring in the literature of those days, was the warning of Christ. No man putting his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God. Luke 9. 62. There are passages in Tertullian and St. Cyprian writing about virgins that may be interpreted as their having taken, and that's very far back, authentic vows. Moreover, it was certain that a woman who had bound herself to Jesus Christ by a profession of virginity was liable to severe canonical penalties. You either didn't make the promise, or if you did, you were punished if you broke it. Saint Cyprian regarded such a person as an adulterous bride. But after having absolved her, he allowed such a one to enter marriage, if, as he said, she could not keep continency. Just for the historical record, the earliest canonical decree of which we know on the subject of vows was that of Pope Saint Siricius, S-I-R-I-C-I-U-S, writing to a certain bishop in 385 A.D. It brands as infamy the carnal intercourse of any monk or virgin. The oldest complete vow formula that we have of a religious, the kind of vow they took, is placed in Egypt from a monastery about the year 400 in one of the monasteries founded by Pachomius. As I read it, you will say to yourself, what kind of a vow is that? Well, we didn't formulate it, we're just quoting the kind of vow they took. The title of the first known vow in the Catholic Church was covenant. I swear before God in his holy temple, in which the word I have spoken is my witness, that I will not defile my body in any way. I will not steal. I will not bear false witness. I will not lie. I will not do wrong in secret. If I break my oath, I am willing, listen to this, not to enter the kingdom of heaven, although I were in sight of it. God, before whom I have made this covenant, will then destroy my body and soul in hell, for I should have broken the oath of allegiance that I have taken. Then, an addition. As for contradiction, disobedience, murmuring, contention, obstinacy, or any such things, these faults are quite manifest to the whole community. The rest of the text is missing, and it seems that community will, and I give them the privilege to take care of me. If I'm obstinate, or contradictory, or disobedient, or contumacious, since everybody will see it, they can take care of me. So much for the law. We don't have the full text, but there's enough there to indicate that it was meant to be taken for life, and the penalties were severe. Sixth feature, canon law. Almost as soon as the church was liberated by Constantine in 315 AD, a hierarchy began to enact formal legislation for religious. The first known church law for religious is in the Council of Gangra, G-A-N-G-R-A, date 330, place Asia Minor. It was addressed to three classes of persons, namely virgins, those who were continent but not virgins, whether married or widowed or otherwise, and third, those who retire from worldly affairs to practice more faithfully the duties of piety towards their parents, children, husband, or wife, and second, to avoid all vanity and pride. Now this is a very interesting and, I think, important feature of that early religious life, that people would be formed into a religious community to take care of their parents or their children, or husband, or wife. In other words, where there is no prospect for a variety of reasons to enter a community, mainly because of their age, or the inability to leave an immediate duty which they had, there were special groups formed, say, of people who wanted to take care of their aged parents. Two important decisions of councils of the church, long before Benedict, paved the way for other essential features of community life. The Council of Chalcedon, it's a general council, date 451, made the erection of a monastery depend on the consent of a bishop. By the way, let's remember that. No community in the Catholic Church exists without the approval of the hierarchy, unknown. And the date for that legislation is 451. Thus, we Jesuits, who are exempt from direct episcopal control, nevertheless, we simply do not enter a diocese unless we are invited by the bishop. And we stay there only as long as he wants us. And the second was a series of councils, mainly in France in the 5th century, legislating perseverance in the religious state. In other words, already 15 centuries ago, the church felt she should make laws, general laws for religious, besides their own specific laws, which are approved by the church for that community. So we have two levels of legislation. Legislation for the community, by the community, and within the community, always to be approved by the church, the church's hierarchy. And second, general legislation applying to all religions. The proposed revision of canon law, and by the way, let's keep this in mind, is not to touch, it is not its intent, the internal government of each institute. The proposed revision of canon law is for the church's general laws affecting all communities, which is why I have been so urgent and urging chapters and religious institutes to make sure that your own domestic laws are clear, specific, and sufficiently detailed, that whatever the new provision for the whole church will be, you will not find yourselves in the impossible position of depending on the universal law for your survival. What, by this time, can we call, we got 2 minutes, the basic rules of religious life? In the transition, we're going to start, beginning with our next classes, we're going to deal with highly organized religious life, starting with Benedict. I think it would be well to recognize that historically the church speaks of 4 basic rules from which all religious communities in the Catholic Church now derive. They are the rule of St. Basil, date 329 to 379. The rule of St. Augustine, his lifespan 354 to 430. The rule of St. Benedict, his lifespan is 480 to 543. And the rule of St. Francis, and I'll give you the first date of the first rule of Francis approved by the church, 1223. Accordingly, there are 2 rules, that of Basil and Augustine, which so far have deserved our special attention, and there will be 2 large rules of Benedict and Francis that we shall see, and besides those 4, so many others, including, I trust, something for everyone here in class, including something about the Society of Jesus.